You've tuned in to the Get Connected podcast. I'm Mike Agarbo here with Carmi Levy today, and we've got some great tech stories that we're following up on. One that we'll get into here shortly in Canada, the Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, has announced a $2.4 billion for AI-related investments. What does that mean? Tesla has settled with a family of a car crash victim, a gentleman who was driving a Tesla and using the self-driving, crashed into a cement freeway barrier and unfortunately died. And so we'll look at some of the details of that and just kind of discuss, are cars, self-driving cars, safe yet? We'll also be chatting about NASA. They've been tasked by the White House to create a time standard for the moon. I guess there'll be moon time as well. And we'll dig into some more AI stories as well. Thanks for joining me, Carmi.
Great to be with you, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about AI investment. You know, obviously, many companies are investing in AI. They're going kind of all in. We see that with the big guys like Amazon, Meta, Google, and even Apple now. They've kind of shut down, you know, from what we understand. We don't have all the detail because they don't really disclose that. They've shut down their car division and kind of funneling more of their effort into AI. And now it looks like Justin Trudeau here in Canada, Prime Minister, announced $2.4 billion for AI-related investments. What are the details first? Then we'll talk about, you know, kind of the implications of that.
Yeah, so they're writing one large $2.4 billion check for the AI industry. And the bulk of that money, the way it breaks down, is $2 billion of that will go toward providing access to compute resources, infrastructure, the high-speed computers required to power artificial intelligence applications. As we know, AI is super compute intensive. And that isn't always affordable for Canadians, for individuals, for researchers, universities, companies, startups, government agencies. So similar to what the government did in an earlier era when they wanted to provide access to high-speed internet, sort of give Canadians a leg up with this new technology, they're taking the same approach with AI, and they really are focusing on giving everyone access to infrastructure. There are smaller amounts of money towards about $200 million to drive adoption of AI in particular sectors, sensitive ones like healthcare, agriculture, clean technology, $50 million for an AI safety institute to protect against the risks that you and I have talked about so often. And then a drop in the bucket, just over $5 million for an Office of the AI and Data Commissioner to enforce the law known as Bill C-27 or the Artificial Intelligence and Data Act when it becomes law. It isn't law yet. It's moving through the pipeline. So, you know, smaller amounts of money for all sorts of different things, but really the bulk of it is, you know, let Canadians get access to it, let them figure out how it works, make it a little bit more affordable so that we can build businesses on top of that. But it really is, it sounds like a big dollar amount, but in the overall scheme of things, not a whole lot. It's seed money, and hopefully everyone else will dive in and start adding their own investments to that pile.
I think you hit the nail on the head. It sounds like a lot of money, but compared to some of these other companies out there, it's not huge. You think it's going to make a difference? Will this spur Canadian investment?
I think it galvanizes attention. It shows that the government is finally getting serious about AI a year and a half after it was driven into the mainstream with the release of ChatGPT. Most Canadians have been playing with these tools since they first became available. We're, you know, similar to what it was like in the early days of Google search, for example, when we would just load it up and see what it could do. We've sort of been doing that now for a year and a half, and it's taken that long for the federal government to wake up and say, okay, now we've got to have concrete plans for this. So a little slow on the uptake, but as we know in technology, that is always the way our government works. We are followers, not leaders. And so we'll take the money. I'm happy to sort of see them recognizing the priority. But at the same time, you can't just write a check and expect everyone to know what to do with that money. You need to have actions around it, concrete plans, roadmaps, strategies. You need to target particular parts of the economy and make sure that they're on board with these announcements as well. And that doesn't seem to be the case here. In the U.S., for example, the White House is mandating federal government agencies to have a chief AI officer in place within the next 2 months. And so they're actually moving forward, rolling up their sleeves and doing something. And then the budget will come. We're simply sending money, but not telling everyone what to do with it. So yet again, we're behind the curve. And it means that other countries are probably going to get to that sort of AI momentum state where the economy is integrating it well, where startups are starting to identify products and services that they can bring to market, where schools are updating their curriculum to make sure that we have the training and we have the workforce ready to take on these new AI challenges. I'm not seeing a lot of the signs of that in this announcement. And the fact that it took place amid a string of similar announcements in the lead up to the federal budget makes it very clear that this really wasn't so much about laying the groundwork for Canada's AI future as much as it was just making a political statement and hoping that voters go for it.
Yeah, I'm always concerned when they announce these types of, chunks of money to invest in certain areas. Is government always the best judge of what companies and individuals should get this money? You know, I'm just thinking even about the ArriveCan app, and I know it's not, exactly the same as, AI or what they're trying to do here, but, that was a boondoggle of epic proportions, and I'm just concerned when they just start flooding the market with this kind of money. Who's kind of like overseeing that? Who's looking after it? I know they want to set up kind of an office and what have you, but that takes a while.
It certainly does. AI is still so new that we don't have infrastructure around how these resources will be used, how Canada's AI strategy will be defined, and how it will be managed over time. And let's be clear, we need a strategy, because otherwise you will have individual startups figuring out their own thing. You'll have individual educational institutions, both school boards as well as colleges and universities, coming up with their own approach and crossing their fingers and hoping that it's okay. So you do need some guidance from the federal government to sort of give everyone a North Star, a target to shoot for, as this revolutionary technology starts to take hold on the economy. And we're really seeing none of that. And, all you need to do is watch a parliamentary committee meeting on AI to realize that most of our elected officials and the agencies that support them really they're at the same state as you and I are. We're all still figuring this out as citizens, and the government is really in the same boat. So, I wish I could say this is going to end well, but no, we've seen time and time again where the government makes investments in technology. So, certainly we had ArriveCan, we had COVID Alert, we have the Phoenix Pay system. There are any number of examples where the government invests in high-profile technology projects only to have them go off the rails simply because they don't have the right strategy, the right people, the right training, the right oversight in place, or the right structures. And that is likely going to be the same case here. The problem with AI is the scope is so much broader and it's moving so much more quickly than any other technology. I worry we're going to fall behind and it's just going to be just an absolute mess.
Yeah, I guess the challenge here is, it's so nebulous. I don't, with ArriveCan and some of these other things, you could kind of point to specific projects, but this is kind of more airy-fairy, I guess, in my opinion, right? So I guess it'll be hard. It'll be harder to hold them to account.
Very much so. And I think, similar to what we've seen in previous generations. So, for example, when the commercial internet was first becoming a thing in the mid-90s, late 90s, and then the web and web 2.0 and smartphones and wireless, we look to the economy. In other words, what companies are developing innovative technologies? Are they getting, who is the next BlackBerry? Are they getting the resources they need from the appropriate levels of government? And are they being fed by the educational institutions that are pumping out the talent that they need to do what they do and compete globally? And it's safe to say that during previous generations, our education system, various levels of government, the business community, more or less figured it out. And, you know, we had some success stories. And I would like to think that the same will happen here. We already have AI centers of excellence in Montreal and Toronto. We already have the Mila Institute in Montreal, which is home to Yeshua Bengio, who's kind of like the AI global rock star, if ever there was one. So we've already got a lot of research and a lot of good stuff happening here in Canada. We just need more funding, more resources, and more guidance from the government. And you know, certainly money helps and it gets things started, but it's a marathon, not a sprint. And you can't expect the government to just have a one-time funding announcement and call it a day. This really needs to be ongoing. And certainly as we spin up to the next election, questions for candidates and for federal parties will be, what is your long-term strategy around artificial intelligence? What does that look like? Are we incorporating best practices from other countries, other jurisdictions, the European Union, et cetera? And are we making sure that Canada stays within sight of other countries that are doing AI well? Or are we going to have another ArriveCan debacle? It can go either way. We just got to be smart about it.
Let's move on to another car crash. And this is an unfortunate one. Happened back in March 23rd, 2018, down in Silicon Valley. You've probably seen this in the news. A gentleman, his name is Walter Hung, he was killed when his Tesla hit a concrete highway median. He had autopilot engaged from the investigation. It had been on for nearly 19 minutes before the fatal crash, and the car was traveling at 71 miles per hour and veered off the highway. The family sued Tesla, saying that, you know, there was too much of a, I guess, expectation of autopilot to like completely take over the driving of the vehicle. You know, Elon Musk has fought back on these types of lawsuits in the past, and I think he's won actually. But this one, they look like they settled. So I think that was kind of interesting. Again, this was back in 2018. You know, the technology was good, but it's still kind of far off from where we are today with the, the self-driving technology that, you know, Teslas have available.
Yeah, I found it interesting that they settled almost literally within hours of the trial beginning. And this comes after, I think there were at least two other cases where Tesla won those cases. A similar case, the autopilot was engaged, there was an accident, and there were fatalities involved. And in those cases, Tesla won based on its ability to prove that the drivers at the time were not maintaining attention, that they were looking at their phones or doing something else, but they did not have two hands on the wheel looking around the vehicle ready to take over if they needed to. And so the fact that they settled just before the trial began in this case suggests that perhaps that defense was no longer an option, that there was sufficient evidence that Tesla didn't think they could prove that this particular driver had been, say, looking at his phone or doing something other than driving at the time of this accident. So, you know, and I think that sort of it illustrates just how fraught these trials are and how even today in 2024, the technology is still not full level 5 autonomy. And you still need to have human intervention. And where those lines are drawn between semi-autonomous systems controlling the car versus humans being standing by ready to take over, those are not clear. And Tesla's, we won't call it marketing because they don't have a marketing department anymore, but certainly Tesla's messaging around autopilot and full self-driving in the past has overstated just how capable they are, to the point that many drivers do. They'll nap at the wheel, or they'll do their email, or they'll watch a movie on their phone, and much to the detriment of the technology. And in some cases, they will get themselves into trouble. And I think this begs the question of why we aren't having a broader conversation about how these companies are marketing their semi-autonomous systems and what safety protocols are in place to ensure that drivers don't misinterpret the messaging around them and aren't as careful as they need to be at the wheel. This is a human factors problem, and the automakers, including Tesla, have a role to play, and I don't think they've stepped up to the degree that they should.
It's interesting. So some more of the details here. This particular gentleman, it was shown that he didn't have his hands on the car steering wheel for 6 seconds prior to the crash. And he it was found that he was playing a video game on his phone while autopilot was engaged. And this was kind of known, like the family admitted that he did play video games while he had autopilot on. So, you know, there might have been a chance that Tesla won this, but I'm just wondering if it comes down to timing now as well. You know, this past month, they actually gave all Tesla owners in the US and Canada their full self-driving feature to try out for 30 days for free. I've been using it for the past couple of weeks. It is beyond amazing, Carmi. Like, it just blows my mind. I'm just wondering, did they settle because of the timing of, you know, this rollout? And would that kind of drawn more attention to them? Because the last thing they need is a class action suit.
Yeah, absolutely. And they certainly don't want the media cycle generating headlines that are critical of this technology, this, and let's admit it, very profitable technology, high margin technology, at a time when they are hoping to convert large numbers of drivers to this technology. Let's remind our listeners that just about every Tesla ships with the hardware for this. You can subscribe to it. You can buy the access to it by paying, I don't know, I think it was $12,000 US, some yeah, amount of money. And so part of this promotion by giving everyone access to it for a month is allowing them to try it, hoping that they are so positive about the experience that they'll be willing to pony up the dough, which will then unlock the hardware that's already built into their vehicles. So I think the last thing Tesla wants at this time is that negative publicity from a trial, a case that's ongoing. And by settling now and sort of burying it, they allow this promotion to go ahead unfettered. We know full well that Tesla, their sales targets, they're not hitting them. We know that sales are softening. Competing automakers are bringing other models to market. There's increased questioning in the market that the growth rate of electric vehicles still positive. They're still selling more than they have ever before, but they're not growing as fast as they were previously. And so Tesla used to have, kind of an open field to grow. It's no longer the case, and that's been reflected in its share values lately. So the company is sort of looking strategically and trying to pare things back. And I think it makes sense for them to settle this. And I think we'll probably see them take a similar approach in future. They've got to get more drivers to convert to this technology because they make more money off of that than they do selling the car. And they can't afford any distractions from any ongoing legal action.
Yeah, it's been an interesting couple of weeks with the feature. And again, they call it, they've rebranded it. They call it full self-driving supervised. And so I've used it, my commute is about 45 minutes to an hour each way from my home in White Rock to downtown Vancouver. I've used it many times there now. Also, I took the car up to Whistler and had the self-driving on the full time. And Carmi, it was spotless. It made no mistakes. However, with the feature, you every couple minutes, it requires you to kind of shake the steering wheel a little bit to show that you are truly engaged. And because they have a camera on the inside of the car kind of looking right at you, it knows if you're looking down at your cell phone or anything like that, and it will stop the self-driving like immediately and give you a warning. I think you only get 5 chances and it'll shut off forever.
I think that's important, because again, left to our own devices, we know that a certain small percentage of humans will find all sorts of ways to defeat the technology. So by using technology to force attention on the act of driving or overseeing the technology, I think that's a good thing. And again, good on Tesla for recognizing that this is how individuals were misusing the technology and that they've updated it accordingly to sort of reduce the potential for workaround. But I also think this is where government agencies, the Transportation Department here in Canada, Department of Transportation in the U.S., need to play a more prominent role in holding auto companies to account in terms of what those safety standards are. If you want to bring a change to your headlight design to market, you have to go through years of consultations with federal officials, and they will sign off on it. And their lights, there are certain kinds of lights that we don't get in North America because they will not authorize them. They get them in Europe. So the fact that we have so much regulation for lights, but not for self-driving technology that could or could not kill you if it's misused, I think highlights a huge gap here, and certainly our regulatory agencies need to get with the program, because this is technology. Imagine on a long drive, this is life-changing technology. It can allow you to get there far more rested. It means more aware drivers. It means safer roads. It means less opportunity for distracted driving. The benefit potential is so huge. We owe it to ourselves to make sure that everyone is playing by the right playbook and the same set of rules, and that we all have access to these technologies going forward. I would certainly love to see a day when autonomy is the rule of the road, as opposed to whatever it is that we have now, where people think it's okay to play video games while they drive.
Let's move on to our next story that I spoke of at the beginning of the program. It looks like the White House, and I don't know what has driven this, has directed NASA to create a time standard for the moon and other celestial bodies. I guess that's a good question. Like, what time is it on the moon? And can can that even be kind of coordinated with the time on Earth? Because, you know, the moon is rotating. I don't know. It seems like an easy thing, but at the same time, my brain's going, no, that sounds very complicated to figure that out.
Yeah, it is complicated. But I think what space agencies and governments, not just in the U.S., but everywhere, are finding that as you move out away from the Earth toward the moon and planets and other celestial bodies, timekeeping, where you use the Earth's time as a baseline, just doesn't work. Because perception of time is different based on where you are in the solar system. So, for example, if you're standing on the moon, an Earth-based clock, and according to the research, it would look like it's losing an average of about 58.7 microseconds every Earth day. And there are other factors in sort of the way the moon orbits the Earth, or the way we're all moving through space, that can change that as well. So they're proposing, they've asked NASA and other parts of the U.S. government to work on a plan, and they have until the end of 2026 to come up with a strategy. They're calling it Coordinated Lunar Time, or LTC. And it's a lot like Coordinated Universal Time, or UTC, on Earth, but for the moon and celestial bodies. And that's important because we have the Artemis program, we're going to the moon. Jeremy Hansen is going to be on Artemis 2. We have SpaceX developing Starship, which is supposed to also go to the moon, part of Artemis, as well as to Mars. And so using existing time protocols and technologies means that we may not have the right time, and that they have to come up with a better way. So LTC is that way. What will it look like? We don't really know, but it answers the question, is the way we tell time on Earth okay for telling time on the moon? And the U.S. government is saying it isn't. NASA, we want you to fix it.
So it's the Americans to the rescue? Like, there's no other country?
Yeah.
Like the EU? You'd think the EU would be all over this, or Russia.
You would. Yeah, the EU is usually first to mandate something like this. And this is where sort of the globality of space travel becomes apparent. So there's something called the Artemis Accords, and the EU is part of it, has signed on to it. 36 countries, including the US and Canada, has signed on to it. And basically what it does, it provides a framework, a legal framework, for appropriate behaviors in space and on the moon, recognizing that, you know, there is going to be more exploration on the moon. We're already seeing a lot of unmanned probes landing on the moon, or targeting the moon, orbiting the moon. And of course, the Artemis missions are going to bring humans back to the moon within a few years. And so these countries recognize the need for a general set of rules so that no one kind of takes advantage. The only problem here is China and Russia have not signed on to the Artemis Accord. So we may very well end up in a situation where we have this new way of telling time in space, but China and Russia don't agree, whereas all other countries do. So yet again, we have politics on Earth affecting how things play out in space, and that could be a problem going forward. And unfortunately, the US and NASA at this point don't have an answer for that. I'm guessing the diplomats will keep talking to each other. Hopefully soon, at some point, China and Russia will agree to come on board. But it's whether they do is anyone's guess.
Let's move on to AI again. And it's kind of interesting how quickly it has advanced. We've seen things like ChatGPT, Midjourney, the text-to-image engine, DALL-E is another very popular one. OpenAI has been kind of at the forefront of that. They are the guys behind ChatGPT, also DALL-E, they are going to be launching something called Sora, which is text to video. And if you haven't looked at the examples that they've done yet for Sora, you need to go on right after this podcast and check it out, because it will blow your mind. I've seen some of the clips that they've done, and it just looks real. It's just so real, like humans and flyovers and cars driving. They've even done kind of animated kind of Pixar-like shorts as well. I just can't believe it's advanced so quickly. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is just for these different AI tools, these large language models, the generative AI that we're all starting to use now, for them to be so good, they have to ingest enormous amounts of data and learn from that data, scraping the internet and databases, stock photo sites, for example, in the example of imagery. But there was an interesting thing when I was kind of digging down into the Sora story from OpenAI. Again, that's the text-to-video engine. And they interviewed the CTO, the chief technical officer of OpenAI, Carmi, and she basically couldn't confirm or deny whether they actually used data from companies like YouTube. She didn't know, or so she claimed. Like, how, you're the chief technology officer. Where are you getting the information? Like, how do you not know that? Or is she just hiding that? And then, you know, there's other stories like Meta, the Facebook folks, and this was from Business Insider, saying that they're desperate for data sources. They even weighed risking copyright lawsuits. They even looked at purchasing that huge publishing house, Simon & Schuster, to get the data, essentially. So it is kind of like an arms race right now. And I just wonder how much bending of the rules and what have you that these big guys are doing.
It's the dirty little secret of the AI industry, of how those large language models are trained, what data is being fed into them as part of that training process, where it's coming from, and just as critically, what conversations, if any, are being had between those doing the data harvesting and those whose data is being harvested. And in many cases, the short answer is nothing. The reason that OpenAI's CTO did not answer that question, they could have. They chose not to because they knew that the answer would put them in significant legal jeopardy. The scary answer here is that it's been open season up until now, that all of the majority of the tools that we're starting to use on a day-to-day basis were trained using methods that essentially violated copyright, that did not include requests or legal requests for permission to access that data. The operative sort of methodology was, well, if it's out there on the open internet, it's kind of fair game, so I'm just going to suck it up and throw it into my tool. That's where we're at now. And the problem now is that a year and a half after ChatGPT first went live, a lot of people who are responsible for a lot of that data, so think photo repositories on Getty or Shutterstock, or people who have been maintaining blogs for years and have lots of content out there, or websites, or databases and repositories, they're starting to realize that their data was included without their permission or knowledge. No one reached out to them before this scraping or harvesting process happened, which is, it brings us into a new, frankly, frightening copyright era. And it's prompted Alphabet, which owns YouTube, to explicitly tell OpenAI, do not use our platform for data harvesting. We're reaching a point where we are going to require these technology companies to be a lot more upfront about where they get their data from and what arrangements they've made to get that data before they actually turn on the giant data vacuums. That hasn't been happening up until now, and that's gonna spawn a lot of lawsuits in the months and years to come, and it's only a matter of time before they start working their way through the courts.
Well, talking about ingesting data so that these AI engines can actually make the creations we ask them to, This was kind of interesting. Meta, they're working on their own AI tools, an image generator as well. But the one that they have apparently is unable to create pictures of Asian men with white women. Which is ironic because Mark Zuckerberg is married to Priscilla Chan, a Chinese American. And so you'd I guess put in the prompt Asian man and white wife, or Asian man and Caucasian friend, and the AI tool could just not do it. Like, it was unable to.
Yeah. And I think so The Verge sort of did this experiment, and they ran a number of prompts, and I think out of dozens of attempts, I think only one of them surfaced a photo that actually had a person of, you know, a Caucasian individual and an Asian individual in the same photo. And this sort of links us right back to, how was this tool trained? What data was fed into it that resulted in the weird output that we're getting here? And if you look at, for example, an online photo repository, which I think we can surmise that that's what Meta was using for much of its training operations, that there is not a whole lot of diversity in those photos. That if you took the sort of the entire library, you'd realize there just aren't a lot of photos of Asian and white people in the same frame in that photographic database. And so AI simply reflects what it's been trained on. It's not smart enough to know the difference. And I think that's where we have to give ourselves a bit of a pause. You know, in technology, we were often told garbage in, garbage out. Your solution is only as strong as the data that's fed through it. And the same thing applies here with AI, that these tools are not smart enough to know that the data that they're getting is not diverse, is not properly balanced, and that there are gaps in it. And this is just one example of it. You know, in this politically correct age, of course, it generates a headline, but this is hardly the only example. And I think that's why we've got to give ourselves pause, that if we're using AI tools to get answers, those answers are going to be reflective of a pretty imbalanced data environment. And I think it illustrates the need for us to be a lot more upfront, open, transparent about the data ingestion protocols that are being followed to create these tools that we're increasingly relying on.
In fairness, you know, many users pointed out that other AI image generators like Midjourney, DALL-E 3, Bing, Adobe Firefly had the same issue. Because, you know, obviously they're ingesting stuff from the same databases and image libraries, right?
Exactly. Everyone is training in exactly the same way, probably using, if not identical sources, similar or overlapping sources of data. And so I think the whole industry needs to give its head a shake and ask itself, does this model, whereby we train large language models using data that has been sourced from various locations on the open internet, is that the way we should proceed going forward? Or is there a better way to build AI tools and platforms? And because clearly we haven't figured out the data training thing just yet, and it's leading to some really weird results. And quite frankly, I'm concerned, especially as Google, for example, moves ahead with its search generative experience, where they're essentially converting or adding AI capabilities to their core search tools. If we can't trust, an AI tool to return a photo of, you know, diversity of white people with Caucasian people in the same frame, do we trust the search results that we're getting from our next Google search because they're now AI enabled? Or did that data harvesting problem that we saw in the photo example, does that manifest itself in a basic search result as well? And so we have to ask ourselves the questions, and I think we have to hold these companies to a higher standard, because clearly the accuracy and the precision aren't there, and they're not going to be there until we change the very architecture of how these things are built.
That's all the time we have for our podcast today. I want to thank Carmi for joining me once again. Don't forget to recommend our podcast to your friends and family. You know, we can check out our website as well, www.getconnectedmedia.com. All sorts of great content there as well. This is Mike and Carmi signing off. We'll see you again next time.